Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Christian churches around the world are struggling with sex scandals and with how to deal with changing views on sexuality. The sins of priests within the Catholic Church and their sexual escapades with children are abhorrent, even as the response of the hierarchy has been shameful. And recently, the Southern Baptist Church has been plagued with sexual indiscretions involving pastors, youth pastors, and volunteers. We'll be talking later about how and why religious organizations have suffered from these crises and how the atmosphere that allows these actions might be changed to prevent them. But first, another problem of a church wrestling with the intersection of sex and sexuality and changing attitudes about both. The United Methodist Church made headlines recently when church leaders rejected the One Church plan, which would have reduced restrictions on LGBTQ clergy and same-sex marriage. Now the church faces a potential split. Elizabeth Dias covers faith and politics for the New York Times as their national religion correspondent. She also has an undergraduate degree in theology from Wheaton College and a master's in divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary and has been following this story. She joins us via Skype. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Mike.
And James Howell is pastor of Myers Park United Methodist. He is with us by phone. Nice to have you back as well.
Thanks, Mike.
People may have some things to say about this as we go through the program. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks as well. This so-called One Church plan was taken up at a special session of the United Methodist Church's General Conference. Reverend Howell, you were there, so describe the atmosphere in general as well as the atmosphere at the beginning and again at the end of the conference.
Well, we arrived in St. Louis, and it was pretty tense. And by the time people left, it was ugly. And so we were trying what's hard, right, which is to keep people who think differently on this together. So on the one hand, you have people who, they already fear civilization is crumbling around them. And there's a lot of fear in that, so they cling to the thing they know, like being straight, and there's unfamiliarity. And then you have other people, the dream of a world that may never dawn, that they dream of, so they have that fear. And they're all trying to do well by God, but then they come from all over the world. We don't speak the same language. 1,000 delegates operating by Robert's Rules of Order is the worst conceivable way to have a conversation or to make a decision. So, not pretty.
Yeah. So why was this taken up for discussion now?
Oh, well, this has been going on for decades. And in 2016, at our general conference usually is every 4 years. So in 2016, people were just kind of weary, and it invades the rest of the conference. We said, let's have a special conference and settle it once for all. Not sure that actually happened, but that was the dream.
Were the concerns more widespread than simply the ordination of LGBTQ clergy and the performance of same-sex marriage? I mean, I know that people were concerned that the Book of Discipline contained, quote, language contradictory and unnecessarily hurtful and inadequate for a variety of local, regional, and global contexts. Was there more to it than just those two things?
Oh, I mean, you get the kind of smokescreen issues over it. People say it's above biblical authority, but, you know, different people read the Bible differently, and the people saying, I'm not mocking them, but people who say we have to stand by the Bible on this, you know, they don't stand by the Bible. Because we also, at this session, argued about our pension fund, and Jesus said, do not lay up treasure on earth, but we're concerned about the pension fund, right? So there's kind of Bible reading. And what the One Church plan tried to say is, you know, different people parse these things differently, that they love God, they love the Bible, and can't we stay together as a witness to the world that we don't have to be broken and fractured like everybody else? We can be together. We can differ the way you do in a family, the way you do in any friendship. That's hard, though.
Elizabeth, a lot of churches are struggling with how to handle the same-sex marriage issue and homosexuality in general. And in one of your articles in this, you mentioned conservatives have left the Episcopal Church over gay rights, Presbyterians have split, many young evangelicals are leaving their churches over the lack of inclusion of LGBT people. Theologically, why is this so difficult for Christian churches?
Well, I think it's also a big cultural question, right? I mean, religious change tends to happen so slowly. Theological change takes, we're not talking decades, it's centuries, millennia for big shifts to happen. And so right now we're in, especially in the United States, the culture changing very quickly on issues of LGBTQ rights. And so we're seeing this big culture clash between how many Christian traditions have long conceived of these issues and an increasingly secular society that is changing very rapidly on these questions.
But you just hit on the key. The culture is secular. Churches, Christian churches, are supposed to be about love and inclusion.
Changing very rapidly themselves, too. I mean, all the mainline denominations include Methodists and Episcopal Presbyterians. They're all seeing declining membership, and young people especially are increasingly unaffiliated from religious traditions. So I think there's a big identity question here of who churches are, what values they're going to stake themselves on going forward.
If Christian churches are so concerned with bringing people into the fold and bringing people to Christ, why are they actively driving away particularly at a time when American mainline churches are experiencing declining membership, Reverend Howell?
Oh, I mean, I've said 100 times, it's not the case that people outside the church, especially young people outside the church, are just waiting for us to condemn homosexuality, and then we'll come to church. Then we want to learn about Jesus. You know, it's actually the opposite. And,
Well, historically, when churches go against the tide, and society is making this shift, it's slow, but it has made a remarkable shift in just the last 5 or 10 years. When churches go against the flow of a societal evolution, what happens to those churches? James.
So many things evolve in society. So not everything that goes on in society is something that the church wants to embrace. For instance, the political rancor that we see. It's not like, oh, we have that in society now. Let's do that. We don't want to do that. We want to offer an alternative to that, right? So how do you pick and choose with what's going on to stay, what they say is, on the right side of history? And so with something like same-gender marriage or ordination of LGBTQ people, you know, it's a matter of some people say, look, it's in the Bible. This is just not of God. We don't hate anybody. We want to include everybody, but this is the teaching of the church. Others look at it and say, Christian marriage isn't just like guy, girl. It's about a witness to the world. It's about being called by God. It's about serving God together in a committed relationship. So, and that's just hard for people to wrestle with because it's visceral stuff, right? When you talk about sex, it's like, you know, way down in the gut, and our brains don't work very well when we talk about such matters.
So, William Hinson, who I think is with your church in Alabama, who is described as a force to be reckoned with within your church, says it is time for us to end this cycle of pain that we are inflicting on each other. There's a great gulf fixed between those of us who are centered in Scripture and our friends who are of another persuasion. Repeatedly, they have spoken of the need to get our church in step with our culture. We, on the other hand, have no desire to be the chaplain to an increasingly godless society. What is the rebuttal to that from the other side within the Methodist Church?
So we have, coming to our church, for instance, we have godly LGBTQ. I hate to refer to the LGBTQ communities like they're ghettoized somewhere. They're us. We're them. So they love Jesus. They love church. They're not godless. They're godly people. There are a lot of straight married people who aren't so very godly. They've made a mess out of marriage themselves. And so I just that's a shrill to me. A shrill approach. Now, I appreciate and love many people that are conservative, and the One Church plan tried to say we can be in church together and disagree on this. But what we don't want to do, and a lot of us have been trying to fight hard for, is like stop hurting people. The conservatives don't realize the pain that they inflict on other people and the way they push other people away from God. And you know, have cases of suicides and so on, right, where people feel so guilty because they've let God down, they've let their church down. And that's just got to stop. Like, we've got to stand with the people that are wounded by the church and say, we love you. You're part of us. We want you here. You're not evil, wicked, you're just who you are. You're the way God made you. Come with us and let's join in this adventure of serving God together.
Elizabeth, he's on one side of this issue. Obviously, the Reverend William Hinson is on the other side of this issue, and he just referred to the church as wounding gay people. Why do they stay? What? If you're not welcomed, if you are told that you are wrong and you are sinful, etc., why stay?
Well, I'm reminded of a young man that I met the morning after the decision. I went to Foundry United Methodist here in Washington, D.C., which is a historic, more progressive church on gay rights questions. The Clinton family went there, and this young man is a candidate for ordination, and he told me very movingly about growing up and loving his church in Western Ohio and being called to preach at age 12 or 13, but he also knew the church's rules about homosexuality, so he never thought he could achieve this dream and serve God in this way. So he left the Methodist tradition, and then years later, he's in his 20s now, he found Foundry, which is accepting of gay and lesbian candidates for ministry. And, you know, he just broke down talking about what it was like to actually be able to serve God in this way that fully accepts who he is and allows him to serve the church. So I think it's much more complicated, and this is not just ideological. This is a very human question for people. Mm-hmm.
So delegates to the United Methodist Church special session voted 438 to 384. It was pretty close against the so-called One Church plan, which would have allowed for the ordination of LGBTQ people and would have done some would have allowed churches to decide for themselves, I believe, whether or not gay marriages would be performed. And they voted instead against the in favor of the traditional plan. What is did I correctly frame, James, the thrust of the One Church plan, and what is the upshot of the traditional plan?
Well, that's correct. So we've had the traditional plan since 1972, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, we've had this language, we do not condone the practice of homosexuality. I'd point out that's never prevented anybody from being gay. And the miracle in Methodism is those people stayed and they love the church. Part of what I try to remember, you say, who's wounded by this decision? We think about LGBTQ people, but actually everybody's wounded by it, right? Because we're one people, and anytime there's this kind of exclusion and pushback and lack of understanding of others, everybody—it's toxic for everybody to have that, right? So, and I point out the One Church plan—it was a narrow vote, like it was close. And you have to remember we're an international body, so you have delegates from Russia, from countries in sub-Saharan Africa where homosexuality is illegal or punishable. So there are a lot of the voters, and it still was a very narrow vote. So I always want people here to hear that we Methodists, most of us here in Charlotte, we want to embrace both conservatives and progressives and centrists. I think they're just more centrist than anything else. We long for centrism in our political life, and I think we need it in the church as well.
I'm going to lose you as we go to the break, James Howell, but according to one reporter, this came at a time when an increasing number of Methodist clergy have come out as gay. This is a slap in their faces. What happens to those people now in 20 seconds or less?
Oh, I mean, you know, time will tell. There have always been gay clergy, of course, right? They've had to be in the closet and hide. How this is going to shake out, we don't know. There may be a split in the church. I'd regret that, but at some point, it's arming.
We'll come back to that in a second. James Howell has to leave us, however. He's the pastor at Myers Park United Methodist Church. We'll come back with more of this conversation with Elizabeth Dias from the New York Times. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about the intersection of sex, sexuality, and Christianity, particularly with regard to the Methodist Church, which just had their meeting, the United Methodist Church, in which they voted for the traditional plan over something new called the One Church Plan, which essentially says that they will not be ordaining LGBTQ clergy and LGBTQ people. can't be married in that faith tradition. Later on, we'll look at the Catholic and the Baptist Church and their own problems with sex and sexuality. We're joined by Elizabeth Dias, who is the national religion correspondent for The New York Times. The bishops of the United Methodist Church recommended endorsing the One Church plan at that recent meeting, but there were people in the Methodist tradition, there were clergy there voting, there were church members there voting. So who tipped the scales? Was it the clergy in favor of the traditional plan? Was it the membership who was there that are not clergy that tipped it toward the traditional? What was the breakdown? Do we know?
Well, the votes are anonymous, so we don't know, you know, how each individual voted. But what we do know is that almost two-thirds of the delegates who voted from the United States were in favor of the One Church plan. So it's clearly there's a division on culture and country, and it seems to me that the conservatives the conservative Methodists in the United States were aligned with the Methodists in various African countries and places like Russia and the Philippines, which traditionally have more conservative views on this question.
But under this One Church plan, each individual church, as I understand it, would have had the opportunity to make their own decision about how they wanted to approach this issue. Why would that not placate everybody?
Well, places are more conservative even than that, and resistance to change in general is strong in religious communities, and this question more than any other. So we also have to remember there was a lot of organizing for this up to this vote. You know, it's easy to think this is just a spiritual decision in the moment in an arena in St. Louis where everyone gathered, but coalitions on both sides of the question were essentially vote counting, you know, figuring out who was going to be in their ranks and organizing through WhatsApp channels and meetings across the country for months leading up to this. So this played out in many ways, you know, because I cover politics too, it plays out in many ways with like divisions in the country right now in the political arena.
A lot of the people who voted against the One Church plan and for the traditional plan, I'm told, did so because they say acceptance of same-sex marriage goes against the teachings of Jesus. And one quoted Matthew, who says in the Bible, marriage is between a man and a woman. That's probably from the King James Version. Is that an accurate translation? Because Jesus may have said that, but while Jesus walked the earth, marriage was also between one man and several women.
Well, I can't get into the ins and outs of the history of biblical translation. I'll leave that for other experts. But I can say that this, each generation interprets biblical teaching for itself, and this, you know, so we've been the generations have been doing this ever since Jesus walked on this earth, and since those teachings were first written down. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why right now this is a real cultural wrestling, and this is playing out not just in churches but in families, and this is really about lived experience, not just philosophical or theological principles and ideas.
One member of the conference, Reverend Byron Thomas of the North Georgia Conference, compared this dilemma to the church's earlier handling of race. Is that an apt comparison?
Well, when questions about race were really prevalent in the Methodist conference, there were plenty of similar divisions, right? I mean, the Methodist tradition has split, I think, about a dozen times in its history, most notably around the Civil War and just before the Civil War, when the country was exceedingly divided on race and on slavery. And many people have compared the level of real animosity, frankly, and fear and division that's happening now to what's happened then. I mean, one pastor told me in the wake of the decision, you know, he said, it makes me afraid for what's ahead for our country. know, if the most comparable split in my tradition was just before the Civil War. He said, what the head on questions of sexuality and how that plays out in America?
But these issues of dogma in a church tradition seem to be pretty sticky because every denomination has a set of beliefs. Every church has a set of beliefs. It has to stand for something. So how do you change what you stand for, what you believe, and remain the same organization?
Well, that's what we're seeing in real time right now. We're watching a tradition figure that out and see if that's possible. So in April, late April, we're going to have the next sort of phase of decision coming out of the Methodist tradition when their judicial council meets and rules on the constitutionality of the traditional plan that was passed. And then we'll know from then, you know, what we'll have a better idea of what happens to things like church property and church assets for churches that don't comply with this plan that was passed.
So, because if you split or you take a different direction, who owns the buildings? Who owns the parking lot?
Exactly. And that was a real question when the Episcopal Church went through similar divisions. I mean, these questions, this is not just spiritual. This gets tied up in court, real legal and financial battles to take months, years to work out.
John Wesley, who's the founder of the Methodist Church, believed that schism was a sin. Did that play a role in this decision? Because they know they're leading to something like this, or it could very possibly become a split within the church. Did that play a role in their decision? And do you see a way forward as an innocent bystander looking at it from afar?
Well, it's interesting. You know, both people on both sides of this question were threatening to leave before the vote, right? It wasn't just, you know, progressives would leave or conservatives would leave, depending on the outcome. Everyone was talking about, you know, were they going to be the ones to leave? And now, I'm talking with some of the progressive pastors who are leading the One Church Plan Coalition. They're saying, you know, actually, far from leaving, we're threatening to stay. You know, we will make you force us out. This is our tradition, too. And you don't get to just take our name away, take our church away from us, which is really interesting. And then I was talking with some leaders on the conservative coalitions, and they're still wondering if the decisions were conservative enough for them. So this is still far from settled.
Elizabeth Dias is the national religion correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And earlier we were joined by James Howell, who's the pastor of Myers Park United Methodist Church. We're going to expand the conversation to address other sexual issues with which churches are struggling, the scandals within the Catholic Church that have been going on for decades here and around the world involving priests sexually assaulting children while the hierarchy either covered up the crimes or simply looked the other way, and recent problems reported on by the Houston Chronicle and another paper in Texas involving 20 years of sexual abuse allegations within the nation's largest prominent denomination, the Southern Baptists. We reached out to the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte to invite them to participate. We heard nothing back. We also reached out both to the First Baptist Church of Charlotte and to the Southern Baptist Convention. The church was unaware of the allegations and felt unable to comment. We never heard back from the Southern Baptist Convention. But we will talk about this with Kent Brintnall. He is a religious studies professor at UNC Charlotte who studies both religion and sexuality and the history of sex abuse within the Catholic Church. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. And Tim Funk is here, former reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who for years covered the Faith and Values beat. Welcome back, Tim.
Thank you, John.
Before we move to the Catholics and the Baptists, let's do a little cleanup on the Methodists here. I have some comments that have come in on Facebook and Twitter and emails. Wesley on Facebook, I'm so disappointed in this unchristian position taken by the Methodist Church, I'm considering changing my first name. His first name is Wesley. Deborah on Facebook, the traditional plan condones division and superiority thinking. And Lee emails, I'm not sure why gays and lesbians are not accepted in the church. All of us have sinned, and though the Bible says not to commit acts of homosexuality, it also says not to gossip. This is something that all three of these churches that we're talking about today are dealing with, are wrestling with. Is there a way forward for any of these in with this topic? You study this, Kent.
Well, I think Elizabeth was alluding to this. I think there's always a way forward. The question I think you're implying is there a good way forward? Like, what does that way look like? Schism is a way forward. Churches have split. Traditions have split. Religious people do it badly, often, with a kind of animosity. I think a kind of bringing to religion this notion that religious people somehow are more loving, more inclusive, more just, is a really historical mistake. Religious people have demonstrated that they are as hateful and violent and awful as
and judgmental.
Anyone else. Yeah, anyone else on the planet. I think with the question about exactly what the Methodist Church has decided, I mean, one thing to remember is they're really talking about the ordination of clergy,
right,
who are LGBTQ identified. And there it's who's going to stand in a leadership position. The Methodist Church has not said LGBTQ people can't be members of our churches. Even practicing LGBTQ people can't be members of our churches. The amount of hurt that is there, and I know plenty of gay and lesbian identified Methodist clergy, the amount of hurt that's there is undeniable.
As you reported on this over the years, and as you talk to people within churches, both clergy and lay people within churches, and as you got letters to the editor to you from your writing, Tim, have you noticed a change in position on people? Have they softened? Have they hardened? Are they more willing to be accepting? Are they less willing to be accepting?
Well, I think it's just like the general culture. There are people who have changed, and there are people who are set in their ways.
But overall, if you had to put it on a piece of graph paper, what would you say it would look like?
Well, I think like in the general population, where we've seen a real sea change in the attitude toward LGBTQ people, I think you've seen that in a lot of churches as well. But you've also seen a backlash to that, where conservatives say, you know, that's not what's in the Bible, and they find the, you know, quotes in the passages in the Bible that support their view, and then the other side finds passages that support their view. So we have a fight like we do in the general culture over these issues.
What is it about sex and sexuality that is so difficult for at least Christian denominations and maybe other denominations? Now, I'm sure this is a problem I know it's a problem within Islam. Is it a problem within Asian and Eastern religions as well?
I think that one of the things that sexuality is, if you're religious or if you're not, is sex is kind of scary. Sex is kind of overwhelming.
It's how we all got here.
Yeah, except we don't have a conscious memory of that particular sexuality. But sex is really terrifying, right?
Why?
It's excessive. It can be really unbounded. When one experiences desire for another person, one often feels overwhelmed and overtaken by that. So there's a large desire to keep that kind of constrained and domesticated. I also, one of the things I talk to my students about is the kinds of experiences that sexuality gives us, a sense of transcendence, a sense of connection, a sense of a larger purpose, are the kinds of experiences that religion wants to give us. Mm-hmm. And so I think in some ways religion and sexuality compete with each other over really common
terrain. Is that a conscious competition, do you think?
I don't think it's conscious. I think there are all kinds of tensions in the world that people don't hold explicitly.
So this problem within the Catholic Church of priests abusing and children mostly, but it's also been revealed recently that there are instances of priests abusing nuns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And certainly priests having sex outside of marriage with women who are parishioners. Would it be unfair to say that this church is plagued by this, or is this a problem that really, if we dug deep, we could find in any denomination?
Yes and yes. I think we have to remember when thinking about the Catholic sex abuse crisis that it is not simply a Catholic problem. And it's not simply a problem of religious institutions. People who study these things have pointed out that the profession that is most plagued by sexual abuse of people in their charge are public school teachers. So it's not a religious problem. But I think that the other thing to always remember, especially about the Catholic sex abuse crisis and the Southern Baptist crisis that's unfolding now, or at least coming to attention now, is asking what the crisis is. So it's not, obviously, the sexual abuse of young people is abhorrent, but I think really what people react to so strongly in these traditions is, wait a minute, the people in charge who had a responsibility for stopping this, for preventing this, for responding to it, didn't do anything.
Well, the people in charge are also moral leaders. And for them to turn their heads to ignore this is an abdication of their moral authority. Isn't that what really gets under the skin of a lot of people?
Yes, I think absolutely. And so I think it's often thinking, what is it that people are so incensed about?
Yeah.
And I think that's a big piece of it.
You teach a course that examines the reasons why this continues to happen. Is it because of the traditional closed nature of the Catholic Church and its autonomy in society? In other words, no one ever went beneath the skin of the church. They didn't investigate. They didn't do anything. That was the church. You leave them alone. Was it because of institutional corruption? Is it because of the church not taking these allegations seriously? Is it because it has traditionally been, to use your words, an erotophobic, never heard that word before, an erotophobic institution?
I think it's all of those things. I mean, I think a big piece of it for both Catholicism and the Southern Baptist Church, any institution that is plagued by these kinds of things, is institutions want to protect themselves. They want to protect their ability to exert influence and power. And as you said, the people who are in charge in the Catholic Church had to maintain a certain kind of moral authority. If they admit that everyone in leadership is violating the very ethical principles that the church supposedly stands for, they lose incredible cultural authority. Mm-hmm. So they have to keep that under wraps.
How would you characterize the response? Had this not been a religious institution, would we have known more about this? Would there have been more law enforcement involvement in all of this? And how would you characterize both the response of the church and of law enforcement to this problem, Tim?
Yes, I think there would be a difference. I think there's been a culture of secrecy, certainly in the Catholic Church for thousands of years, really. And it took them a long time to sort of grapple with this, to come to terms with this. You saw up in the Boston Archdiocese in 2002, where the Boston Globe came out,
right,
found that the Archbishop up there, the Cardinal up there, would just move the pedophile priests around and. So a lot of them should have faced justice, but never did.
We're not just going to hit on the Catholics. We're going to go to the Baptists in a few minutes as well to get under the skin of what's been going on there, evidently, for 20 years that the Houston Chronicle uncovered recently with Kent Britnall from UNC Charlotte and Tim Funk, a former religion reporter for The Observer. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Kent Britnall, a religious studies professor at UNC Charlotte, who studies both religion and sexuality and the history of sex abuse in the Catholic Church. He joins us with Tim Funk, former reporter about faith and values for the Charlotte Observer. Before we move on to the Baptist Church and some of the things that they're going through, particularly in Texas, has the existence of celibacy in the priesthood played a major role in what the Catholic Church has had to endure, given the fact that perhaps this has traditionally for thousands of years made this a place with people who are not secure in their sexuality or who are troubled by their sexual desires, a place to go and hide, because traditionally you can remove that because there's celibacy, and perhaps you think you can, but you can't.
Yeah, there are a number of scholars who have argued exactly that especially in the 60s and 70s, when the larger cultural order didn't allow for people who were exploring sort of sexual identity in certain ways, that celibacy became a kind of shield, it became a kind of cover of certain kinds of experiences. As we know from other religious traditions, as we know from sex abuse in families and other professions, celibacy isn't the cause, right? Lots of other people who don't have celibacy as a vow, sexually abuse. I think the other thing that celibacy really does, and I'm convinced by this kind of argument, is that if celibacy is the way in which priests distinguish themselves and make themselves different, perhaps superior to lay people, then when people are violating their vows of celibacy, the institution has to keep that a secret, right? If part of how the institution functions is by priests being really exceptional, then if priests show that they're just like everybody else, there's a real piercing of
illusion. Well, I don't know who wrote this, but this appeared in an article, Tim, in the New York Times. It says, quote, "The closet of the Roman Catholic Church hinges on an impossible contradiction. For years, church leaders have driven gay congregants away in shame and insisted that homosexual tendencies are disordered, and yet thousands of the church's own priests are gay. Now, homosexuality and child pederasty are two distinctly different things, but these scandals between priests and boys has driven gay priests even deeper into the closet, evidently. Doesn't that make this situation even more unhealthy?
Yeah, and I think you've seen not only priests in dioceses, I mean in parishes around, but you've seen some of the top clergy in the Catholic Church who have been called to, you know, have been arrested or have been called out because of this. Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, former Archbishop of Washington, was recently defrocked because of was accused of molesting a choir boy and harassing seminarians. The Australian cardinal, George Pell, who was one of the top clergy in the Vatican, was recently convicted of child sex abuse and could go to jail for 50 years.
And these are recent developments, and it's partly because the church is now taking this seriously and actually taking action on this. But in the Catholic Church, action comes from the top down, usually from the Pope down. There's churches around the diocese around the country have been releasing lists of priests who are under suspicion or who they can say definitely did molest young people. Yeah. The Catholic Archdiocese has yet to release that list. Why?
Well, the Catholic diocese here in Charlotte has
That's
not
what
released
I meant, the Catholic Archdiocese of Charlotte. I'm sorry.
I think you have to have a little background. Last August, a grand jury impaneled by the Attorney General of Pennsylvania came out with a scathing study that showed about 300 priests over the years had molested about 1,000 children. So that has set this has kicked off a new phase where a lot of dioceses around the country have released lists of priests credibly accused of child sex abuse over the years. And all around Charlotte, the diocese of Atlanta, Richmond, Charleston, and the ones in Tennessee have all released these lists, but the Charlotte diocese has not. They said they're still looking at it and waiting to see. They have questions of whether to
include. Why haven't they been forced to release it?
Well,
why haven't law enforcement forced them to release the list?
Well, you know, the Attorney General in North Carolina does not have the same investigative powers that the one in Pennsylvania has, for example. He has called for the Charlotte Diocese to release this, and they are under a lot of pressure to release this list. But so far, it's really up to district attorneys and now in North Carolina, and that just hadn't happened yet.
Until the 1980s, it's my understanding that the Catholic Church, if you were considering a vocation to be a priest, you would go and make that decision around the ninth grade. And many people would go into seminary, religious studies, around the ninth grade. This is at a time when young men, they have no clue who they are, and their sexual maturity is not there at all. They don't do that anymore. They wait till later. Will that help?
Some studies, there are two famous major studies of the sex abuse crisis, the John Jay reports, which are controversial in their conclusions for a number of reasons. But one of the things that they point out is, again, just like you said, this change in seminary education and how it works. Also, the inclusion to greater and greater extent of what the Catholic Church refers to as human formation training, which is basically helping priests think about what it means to be both a sexual being and a celibate being, which was not the case in the 60s and 70s, that those kinds of changes, it seems that it is having some kind of effect. The countervailing tradition is...
They also do better screening, psychological screening.
They do, except, of course, they continue to have a much and much smaller pool.
Right.
So it means that you can't be quite as selective as you wanted to be, especially in parts of the world where you might have several parishes, several dioceses that don't have a priest at all.
Meanwhile, the Houston Chronicle recently investigated church sexual abuse in the Southern Baptist Church over 20 years, looking at, quote, harm done to over 700 survivors, including children as young as 3. A lot of this was done in Sunday schools. The report also details over 200 offenders who were convicted or took plea deals, and a shocking number who, after having done that, returned to the ministry only to abuse again. This has shocking parallels to what has been going on for years in the Catholic Church. There is a power to being in the pulpit and that person is raised above all of the rest of this, the rest of us. Is that what makes this possible?
I think power is the right word. I mean, I think on the Catholic Church issue of we can't, you know, paint with too broad a brush. There are a lot of priests.
Well, in the Catholic Church, a priest, at least when I went to school in the 50s and 60s, the priest was God, period.
Well, and I think that's
end of conversation.
Often the case in these other churches where the pastor is the God,
okay.
Small g. And I think you see that it's celibacy can't be the total answer because it's Southern Baptists and
right.
Fundamentalist Baptists, according to another series.
Well, that's, since it does go across all different religious traditions, is the power of the pulpit something that attracts these kinds of predators?
I think it's more about the power of the position, but it's also about the climate of secrecy, and it's also, frankly, you have to say with the Catholic Church and Southern Baptist, there is pretty much an all-male clergy, and I think that has been part of the problem as well. Mm-hmm. They just need to be more transparent and open up, and I think they've resisted that for a long time. The Pope, I think, is trying to change that, and not totally successfully, but he's, for example, there are now former Episcopal priests who have become Catholic priests who are married. So the door is open to married priests. He's opened the door to women deacons, at least. I don't think you'll see women priests. But I think there's, you know, the Catholic Church moves at a glacial pace, even when you have a, you know, Pope that's trying to change things. So
the Washington Post quotes Marcy Hamilton, who's the chief executive of the anti-abuse nonprofit Child USA, and she says this is a cultural problem. She says it goes across every single organization where any adult has had access to children alone. No prosecutor at this point could possibly believe there are parts of society where this did not happen. It did. That's a quote. So are we wrong to be focusing on churches? Have churches actually helped illuminate a much deeper problem in our society?
They're actually, Brian Kleitz, who's been writing and researching about survivors networks and support groups in the Catholic Church, opens his big piece actually talking about Catholic survivor groups who went and demonstrated when the Penn State scandal was happening. And one of the arguments that they made is, you would not be taking Penn State seriously in the way that you are if we hadn't gone through what we went through and if we hadn't made this, sort of put this on the public agenda. So I think in some ways the Catholic sex abuse crisis has broken things open, but I think the Catholic sex abuse crisis was able to break open because of a lot of agitation in the 70s and 80s by feminists to call attention to sex abuse within families. So there's a long history of how we've had to unlearn a lot of secrets.
The sexual abuse of children is heinous. Is it more so at the hands of clergy than it is at the hands of a daycare provider or a softball coach?
Possibly, because it so violates what they say they stand for. You know, there are the passages in the Bible where Jesus says, bring the little children to me, and whoever, you know, hurts this child is, you know, might as well not have been born. I think it just goes to the it just violates the very nature of what Christianity and other religions say they're about, which is protecting the vulnerable, the ones that are have-nots, you know, children.
And the psychological research actually does show that abuse at the hands, either abuse at the hands of a parent or abuse at the hands of a religious leader, mm-hmm. are the most devastating and long-lasting.
So this investigation by the Houston Chronicle revealed at least 35 church pastors, employees, and volunteers who exhibited predatory behavior were still able to find jobs at churches, and in some cases, churches failed to alert law enforcement about complaints. Several past presidents and prominent leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention are among those criticized by victims for concealing or mishandling abuse complaints within their own churches or seminaries, and this is all from the Houston Chronicle. Some registered sex offenders returned to the pulpit. Others remained there. One's a preacher who sexually assaulted a teenager and is now the principal officer of a Houston nonprofit that works with student organizations. This isn't just happening in Texas. It's happening across the country. And this sounds very much like what happened in the Catholic Church. The society has law enforcement put churches and church officials on a pedestal that makes them untouchable.
Well, you know, I looked up, this is a national problem in the Southern Baptist Church. There were 14 North Carolina ministers or pastors named in this report, and 8 from South Carolina. And a lot of these people in this, I think practically all of them were actually convicted, but a lot of them still found work afterwards. I think it's, again, it's a culture of taking care of the boy. It's a boys' network.
And there are problems within the structure of each of these churches that we've been talking about, the Catholic Church, which is very closed operation and very top-down, and the Southern Baptist Church, which is not top-down at all. I mean, you have there's the Southern Baptist Convention, but correct me if I'm wrong, you're the experts here, but if you come to the Southern Baptist Church, and if you want to be a preacher, you have to convince the congregation that this is your vocation, this you have something to tell them, and they decide whether or not you're going to be in that position, correct?
Yeah, each church calls their own
minister,
and each church is autonomous, unlike the Catholic Church.
And therefore, there is no central database, according to the Chronicle, that tracks ordinations or sexual abuse convictions or allegations. All of that makes these churches highly susceptible to predators. Would you agree?
Yeah, but we live in the age of the internet, and these people can do due diligence.
But a lot of these
Southern
Baptist churches are in very small towns, very isolated. But on the one hand, on the other hand, everybody knows everybody, and these churches play key roles in the lives of the people of the town.
I mean, the other thing to remember, and I think really to take seriously, is that both in the Catholic Church and in the Southern Baptist tradition, there is a logic that people can be transformed, people can be redeemed, people can be forgiven and can change. And so I think sometimes when we bring a secular logic, a legalistic logic, a judicial logic that says, yeah, once a sex offender, always a sex offender, we're really putting a category on that might not work.
Like the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptist Convention has promised that they will reform. They'll make reforms, but it's not top down. It is very open. So can they be successful?
A couple of things. One, the Southern Baptists aren't exactly not top down. They can disaffiliate churches. The Catholic Church also is hierarchical on paper. It's very hard to control a wayward priest or bishop. They don't, have armies or police forces. The other thing I think to remember that the current president of the Southern Baptist Convention is saying all the right things, but the Southern Baptist Church was put on notice in 2008 by women coming forward and saying, we want a database, we want you to screen people, we want you to take this more seriously. And it's a decade later, and they're saying, oh, we'll do it. And I think in some ways Pope Francis is the same way. He's saying, we feel really bad about this. But you've been feeling bad about this for 40 years without real structural change.
They're saying all the right things, but we'll see if they do anything.
So, Twitter comment. The Catholic Church is impacting all branches of Christianity and faith daily by their lack of turning in all who have abused. People can't heal without actual atonement. Karen on Facebook. It's sad that sex is so threatening and that folks in power need to tell us what we can and can't do or whom we can love. Christopher emails, I'm a Presbyterian, happy and faithfully married and bisexual, and also have a transgender adult child who has rejected Christianity in part because of its reputation of hate toward the trans community. I, for one, believe that anything short of total acceptance and love for all people as they are falls short of the message of Jesus. Bad apples should not be allowed to define any organization, whether it's a church or not. But James Howell wrote this in a recent editorial about what happened in their church and their vote against this one church policy. He says, this just underlines in bold ink society's skepticism that church is nothing but a bunch of judgmental hypocrites. That from a minister. Is that the danger here?
I certainly think so.
Especially among young people who may just go away.
Tim Funk, former religion reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Kent Britnall, professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.